This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
We don't have texts for chapter 13, which is the chapter we're doing. So I'm going to read it through to you in English, and then we'll analyze portions of it. Saul was a year in his reign, and he reigned 2 years over Israel. Saul was a year in his reign, and he reigned 2 years over Israel. We'll analyze that sentence at the end of the chapter. Let's just read through it. And Saul chose for himself 3,000 from Israel, and they were with Saul, 2,000 in Michmash, and in the mountain of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan, that's his son, in Givat Binyamin. And he sent the rest of the people, every man to his tent. So he demobilized, reduced the size of the army, and kept 3,000 people. And Jonathan smote the officer of the Philistines. The Philistines had occupied certain parts of the territory of Israel, and they had put an officer in charge there. Jonathan smote the officer of the Philistines, who was in Geva. And the Philistines heard, and Saul sounded the shofar throughout all the land, saying, "Let the Hebrews hear." And all Israel heard, saying, "Saul has smitten the officer of the Philistines, and also that Israel has become hateful to the Philistines." So there's a sense of alert. There's been a crisis. The officer of the Philistines has been killed, and the Philistines are going to be ready to take vengeance on that. And the people gathered after Saul to Gilgal. And the Philistines gathered to wage war with Israel, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 riders, and people as numerous as the sand on the seashore, and they went up and camped in Michmash to the east of Beth Aven. And the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were hard-pressed. And the people hid in the caves and in the thickets and the rocky crags and in the towers and in the pits. They scurried around to find places to hide. They found themselves unable to face the enemy. They were terribly afraid. And some Hebrews crossed the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilad, but Shaul was still in Gilgal, and all the people hurried after him. And he waited 7 days to the appointed time which Shmuel had set. And Shmuel did not come to Gilgal. So there the battle is about to begin, and Shaul is waiting for Shmuel. Shmuel doesn't turn up. And the people scattered from him. Everybody's terrified, everybody's scared. The Philistines are mobilizing, and Shaul is standing there doing nothing. You can imagine what they're saying. They weren't that confident of Shaul in the first place. He has no military experience, he has no might, he has no military charisma. And here's his first major test. The Philistines are gathering, and he's standing. And what is he doing? He says, "I'm waiting for Shmuel, the old man Shmuel, who's supposed to come." Shmuel's the prophet. And Shaul said, "Bring near to me the burnt offering and the peace offering," and he offered up the burnt offering. And it was when he finished offering up the burnt offering that, behold, Shmuel came. And Shaul went out to greet him. The end of the offering. And Shmuel said, "What have you done?" And Shaul said, "For I saw that the people had scattered from me, and you did not come at the appointed time of the days, and the Philistines are gathered in Michmash. And I said, now the Philistines will come down against me to Gilgal, and I have not yet made supplication before Hashem. And I forced myself, and I offered up the burnt offering." And he says, I went through some kind of dilemma, and I forced myself to bring the offering, even though you weren't here. And Shmuel said to Shaul, "You have done foolishly. You have not observed the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his heart, and the Lord has appointed him to be ruler over his people. For you have not kept that which the Lord commanded you." So Shmuel reacts very harshly and says, Shmuel says, Shaul, "You did not wait for me. And that was the instruction, that I should bring the burnt offering. This is a terrible thing, and God has already appointed a successor. You're not going to last very long." Strange thing to tell a man just as he's about to go into battle. And Shmuel rose and went up from Gilgal to Givah Binyamin, and Shaul counted the people who were present with him, about 600 men. So he started with a few thousand. They'd all disappeared. He's got an army of 600 people to face the Philistines. And Saul and his son Jonathan and the people who were present with them were staying in the Givas Binyamin, while the Philistines were encamped in Michmash. And the raiders emerged from the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned to the road leading to Ophrah and to the land of Shaul. And one company turned to the road leading to Beit Horon. And one company turned to the road leading to the border which overlooks the valley of Tzvoim towards the wilderness. Now not a smith was to be found in all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make sword or spear. So they closed down all the foundries and all the blacksmiths, that they weren't able to make any implements. And all of Israel went down to the land of the Philistines to sharpen each man his plowshare and his coulter and his axe and his mattock. So if they did need any metal implements, they had to go to the Philistines to buy them. And if they had to have their knives sharpened and their implements sharpened, that all had to be done at the Philistines. The Philistines controlled anything that could have been turned into, that could have been converted to an armaments industry. So they had no arms at all. And there was a file for the mattocks and for the coulters and for the three-pronged pitchforks and for the axes and to set the goad. And it wasn't the day of war that neither sword nor spear was found in the possession of all the people who were with Shaul and with Jonathan. But Shaul and Jonathan, his son, had them. So what have the Jews got? They've got an army of 600 people, unarmed. The only people who've got any arms at all are the king and his son. And as for the rest of them, they've got nothing. And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the other side of Michmash. That's chapter 13. That's the story that we're going to be dealing with, the episode that we're going to be dealing with this evening. And we'll set out with the first sentence, which I'll translate literally now. The literal translation is Ben Shana Shaul b'Malchosh. Shaul was 1 year old when he ruled. You'll remember the English translation, the way it was translated in English, which is not literal but very correct, was Shaul was a year in his reign. So again, Shaul ben Shana Shaul b'malcho. Shaul was a year into his reign, or when he reigned. Both would be correct grammatically to translate it. One could say b'malcho when he reigned, or into his reign. So it either means this was in the first year of his reign, or he was a year when he reigned. Ushtei shanim malach al Yisrael, and he reigned for 2 years. Now he reigned for more than 2 years, but the 2 years was before the point where David was appointed. So there was a period of overlap, which we're going to study as we start to become introduced to King David. And in a sense, conceptually, we are introduced to King David in this chapter. Although you didn't hear his name mentioned, did you? If I tell you that this is the introduction to King David, can you make the connection? He says already, God has taken has limited your throne and has already appointed your successor. So this is the point at which there is a shift in intent in the kingdom from Shaul to King David. And that's the 2 years. There was only 2 years that Shaul reigned alone, that he reigned without any kind of shadow in the background of King David. Now this Ben Shana Shaul b'Malcho is important in the way it's treated by the Gemara, which I will read to you. The Gemara says the following: why is this worded in such a way as to have double meaning? As to mean not only he was a year into his reign, but also to have an implied meaning of he was 1 year old, which of course is not true. We see he was the tallest man when he was appointed. He was a shepherd. We all these stories we've had, so clearly Shaul was not 1 year old. If so, why word it in such a way where it has this double shade of meaning and could also mean he was 1 year old? Says the Gemara, a statement that we're going to have to deal with. Omar Rav Huna said, Kaven Shana, he was as of a year old, Shelo To'am Tam Chet. He had never tasted the taste of sin. He was absolutely clear and naive in his morality. He was a person who had never tasted the taste of sin. Can I suggest that some of you move up a little bit so that latecomers can just slip in and sit down at the door and they don't have to clamber over people? Thank you. I'm told that if we start at 8:30 punctually for a few weeks, people will start coming at 8:30, which makes good sense. All our I've got to do is make sure that in each shiur there's something that takes place in the first five minutes, which if you don't hear, it messes up the rest of the shiur for you. Then we can be sure that you'll be here by 8:30. So we'll try it. But I didn't do that this week. The Gemara says there is an element of childlike naivety in Shaul. There is an innocence in Shaul, which is important for us to understand in this whole chapter and the coming chapters as well. That's one thing that I want to put to you, and we'll come back and revisit in a few moments. The two questions we've got to ask really are: what was the terrible thing that Shaul did? What was the terrible crime that he committed? His army is small to start with and unarmed, and the Philistines are mobilizing on his border. They're angry because he's killed their officer, so he's trying to establish his domestic independence of the Philistines. They're amassing their armies. The Hebrews are terrified, as one can well understand. And the only advantage they've got is timing. If they can launch the war on their terms before the Philistines are quite ready for it, then the element of surprise might give them an edge. So the officers, you can imagine the scene. They're waiting, the officers come to Shaul and they say, if we launch the attack now, we have a chance. Shaul looks at his watch. He looks down the road, this way and that way. He says, let's wait a little longer. They wait. Every moment they wait, the Philistines are getting stronger and more soldiers are amassing together. And the Jews are getting scared, so every moment a few more disappear and go home. So Shaul's army is shrinking. Every minute it's getting smaller. And the officers come back to Shaul and say, Your Majesty, if we don't do it now, we don't have a chance. And he looks up the road and looks down the road. He says, Has anybody seen Shmuel? And they say, Shmuel's an elderly man. He's the Novi. He's the head of the Beth Din. He's the judge. What are we waiting for Shmuel for? Is he going to launch this attack? You're the king. You command the forces. He says, no, let's wait a little longer. He waits 1 day, 2 days, 3 days. They say to him, when Shaul? And he said, you know, Shmuel said to me, got to wait 7 days. The seventh day comes, and the morning of the seventh day, still no sign of Shaul, of Shmuel. He's left with 600 people. So he says, well, look, let's bring the sacrifices and let's go. As he finishes bringing the sacrifice, Shmuel appears and says, excuse me, why are you bringing sacrifices? Isn't the principle is I bring the sacrifices, the prophet brings the sacrifice, not the king. And my instruction to you was, wait up to 7 days for me. If I don't come at the end of 7 days, then you've waited your bit, there's nothing you can do. But my instruction was, wait the 7 days, and that instruction came from God, not from me. And you went and did this and started the attack on your own, or about to start the attack. Shaul gets very apologetic, and he says, "Vayomer Shaul ki ra'iti ki nafatz ha'am me'alai." I saw that the people were disappearing from me; they were dispersing. And you did not come at the appointed time of the days. You said you would be here and you weren't here. 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, 7 days, you weren't here. And the Philistines are gathered in Michmash. And I said, now the Philistines will come down against me to Gilgal. If they move as close to Gilgal, and I've not yet made supplication before Hashem, I haven't even davened yet. We haven't prayed to God yet. Because we were waiting for you to turn up. But you didn't come. And I forced myself and I offered up the burnt offering. This word forced myself is very interesting. Rashi explains it. Says Rashi, what does it mean I forced myself? Nitchazakti al rutzuni. I overcame my desire. Shoyor libi yomer lahamtin lecho. My heart said, wait for Shmuel. My natural intuition, and here you see the purity. Although he's faced with this onslaught of the Philistines and his dispersing army, his natural intuition was to do God's will. His natural intuition was to wait for Shmuel. He said, I had to force myself to overcome my natural desire to just wait for you and leave it in God's hands. But I went through logically and said, that can't be, I've got to act. I overcame my will and I brought the sacrifice. But that wasn't my natural intuition. That's what I did. And Shmuel tears into him and says, he's Niskalta, you've acted foolishly. You have not observed the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, for now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. And you know what the consequence of that is, Shmuel, Shaul? Don't think you're going to inherit this kingdom to your son. There's going to be somebody else who's going to take it away from you. It wouldn't have been so had you obeyed God, but since you've disobeyed him, that's going to be the outcome. And with that news, and with that sense of horror that he'd done something so serious, he goes into battle with no army, with no arms. And as we'll see next week, he wins. What is the terrible thing that he did? Why is this so terribly serious? Is it a matter of honor and dignity? Shmuel's concerned that he didn't wait for him? What is the big concern? What is the worry? And it's interesting that we have other cases. Shaul does something bad next week again, and we'll link the two, and he gets into a lot of trouble for that as well. And yet David is quite naughty at times too. King David, he does some bad things too, but God forgives him. He doesn't get the same kind of treatment. He's punished, he suffers, but he doesn't get the same kind of treatment, the loss of the kingdom. Why is Shaul punished so heavily? Now there are two dimensions to the wrongdoing that I want to examine. The one is a difficult one to understand, and I'm going to try and explain it. You'll remember we discussed that before the time of the first king of Shaul, causality in Jewish life was completely spiritual. It was morally based. If they did the right thing, they had success. If they did the wrong thing, they failed. The wrong thing morally, the wrong thing spiritually. And they wanted to shift from that into a more natural cause and effect, where they operated more like a regular nation, where they could predict, where they could plan, where they could design strategies. They wanted a more natural system. And so Shaul comes into the picture, the first king. But still there is a degree of overlap. There's still a prophet. It's not like today, where there's 90% natural causality and 10% of godly interference. And before Shaul, it was 90% godly interference and 10% natural. Now during the time of Shaul, it's like 50-50. There's natural causality and there's a godly interference, a godly control as well. And Shmuel represents, the prophet represents the godly dimension, and the king represents the natural political dimension. And they work together. In fighting the battle, there are two parts. There's military preparedness, so there have to be arms, which they didn't have much of. There has to be an army, trained army. There has to be military strategy. And there has to be prayer. There's sacrifice, there's prayer, which precedes the battle. And the prayer is recognized as being as important as the battle. There's no question about that in their minds. Now, prayer the idea that I want to present to you is so fundamental to Judaism and so very, very deep and difficult in the sense that it's often misunderstood. On the one hand, I often say, and it's something that I would support with any argument, that Judaism is probably the only religion in which there is no ritual. There is no ritual in the Torah. Nothing at all. Nothing. With the possible exception of temple service to some degree. But even there, and certainly outside of temple service, there is no ritual. Everything we do has a reason. Everything we do is logical and rational. Sometimes we can fully understand the reason, sometimes we partially understand the reason, but it all fits into a framework of structure, of intellectual structure that can be grasped by the human being. That doesn't mean we always understand the philosophic reason for everything we do. We understand a lot of it. We understand aspects of nearly all of the philosophic reasoning. But even if it's not the philosophic reason that we understand, it all forms part of a mathematical structure. There's nothing we do which is just a ritual, just so. It all fits into a big picture that one can construct and see exactly what the relationship is between that action and all the other actions that we do. Ritual is something which is standalone and dogmatic. That's how you do it, because that's how you do it. That's when it's ritual. We don't have anything like that. Whatever we do fits into a system, to a major system that has a philosophic foundation. On the other hand, there's a great deal of, or on the same hand, in other words, there is a great deal of meaning of subjective input into the mitzvahs we do. It's not just the structure of the mitzvah, it's the feeling that we put into it, the intention we put into it, the sincerity with which we do it, plays an enormous part. But counterbalancing all that subjective element, the feelings, the emotions, the spirituality, the sincerity, the character that we give to the mitzvahs, there is also structure. Now that relationship between structure and content is very interesting, because if you look just at recent times, if you look at times before the 1960s, I don't know going back how long, but up to the 1960s, structure was all important. And content was minimally important. We lived in a very formal society, and science had a big impact on that, and the whole Victorian age had a big impact on that. There was a tremendous emphasis on structure. Some say that was really only until the end of the last century, that the change that became dramatic in the 1960s started already at the turn of the century, or at the time of Einstein. Some put it down to the theory of relativity. Some put it down to the First World War. Some put it a little bit earlier than that. Sorry? The Rite of Spring. As the change, as the point at which it changed. But these things, that there was a point at which, or a phase in which, the subjective content started becoming more important and the structure less important. And it started affecting morality, it started affecting civilization, it started affecting language. It started affecting everything and reached its peak in the 1960s, where that whole hippie generation was, structure is irrelevant. All that's important is what you feel. All that's important is what you think. Impressionism was part of that. Existentialism was part of that. It was all that stuff that started very importantly, because up till that time there was no contact. No content. So impressionism and existentialism and relativity, all these things that said, well, structure's not everything. It depends. It depends on where you are and where the person is in relationship to the object. And a tree is not just a tree. It depends how you see the tree. And this person sees it this way and that person sees it that way. And even the same person can see a tree and paint it in two completely different ways. And that's okay. And everything became relative, because we were dealing with subjective values rather than with objective criteria of dimensions. And the overthrow of external dimensions reached a climax in the 1960s, and we're still feeling the echoes of that until today, where formality disintegrated, and language is one of the big areas where we see it, to such a degree, and behavior and morality and standards and in all sorts of areas. The interesting thing is, one would imagine that technology is all dimension. That technology is engineering and mathematics. And that technology is not content. It doesn't matter what your feeling is when you're dealing with technology. The numbers have to be right. The dimensions have to be right. Another area where one would think that it doesn't matter, that the subjective sides are not important, parts are not important, only the objective, is finance. At the end of the day, you count up the money. It's either there or it isn't there. But we're now moving into a phase where even technology and finance is becoming virtual, which means there is a minimalistic content and structure to everything, including structure itself, because finance is structure and technology is structure. So the last things to cave in are finance and technology, where you don't really need to touch or to hold anything. You don't need anything with dimensions. You don't even need money anymore. You don't need to be able to have anything structured. In religion, it's also gone through its different phases and the different types of religion. Eastern religion focuses primarily on the subject, on the relativity, on the emotions, on the sincerity, on the feelings, on the character. Western religions focused very heavily on structure. Torah has consistently walked down the middle. Anything that has no structure or no content is null and void. It doesn't matter which is missing, they're equally important. If you have content without structure, you have nothing. If you have structure without content, you have nothing. If you're keeping the mitzvahs in a routine way where there is no content, they have some educational validity. You know, you get into a routine and maybe one day you'll put some of yourself into it. But they don't have spiritual validity. The mitzvahs are noshim melumot, or they're monkey actions. They don't have meaning. If you have all the meaning and sincerity, but the action is wrong, you put on your tefillin every morning with the best of intention. The only problem is, unbeknown to you, there's nothing inside the box. The box is empty. But your intention is there and you get up every morning. It's very tragic. Because the fact is, zero. It's nothing. It's very harsh. But that's the fact. The structure is not there, nothing is there. If you just put on your tefillin every morning without any kind of feeling, you put them on and you take them off, also nothing there. It gets worse than that if there's something in your box. But one little edge of one little letter has become rubbed out. That's not 99% of a pair of tefillin that you've got. You don't have a pair of tefillin. It's zero, it's nothing. It's like a computer where one little thing is missing and so it doesn't function. You can't say I've got 99% of a computer. My computer's almost working. Just one little thing isn't working. Nothing's working. If one little thing is not working, nothing's working. So it is with a Sefer Torah. What do we do if we're reading the Torah and we find one little letter is slightly smudged? What do? We don't say, well, let's finish and we'll get it fixed after Shabbos. We stop there and then and we put the Torah away. Take out another Torah. The whole Torah is useless if one little letter is smudged. It's all part of a big circuit. And one part doesn't work without the other part being in place. And the relationship between structure and content has to be there too. Now if we take it a little further, and those who've been learning Gemara with me will appreciate this perhaps a little more easily. And we say, what are the dimensions of structure? And here we need the help of Einstein. The dimensions of structure are length, width, height, mass, volume, position, where, in a frame of reference a thing is placed, is a dimension of structure. And what else? And time. Time is one of the dimensions. A recent discovery. Time is one of the dimensions of structure. That the same object at different times has different structure. That one changes the structure by changing the time. Not something easy to understand, but that's a concept that exists in physics, and it's a concept that exists in the Torah. Time is one of the dimensions. Let's look at an example of that. If you're sitting on Pesach night and you eat your matzah but without any knowledge of what it is, it just so happens in fact that it's Pesach night, you don't even know it's Pesach night, and you're sitting at a restaurant and they run out of bread and all they've got is matzah, so they offer you some matzah and you eat the matzah, do you get a mitzvah? No mitzvah. That's not your intention. There's absolutely zero intent. There's zero mitzvah. You're sitting at your Seder table on Pesach night with everything laid out, and you've been preparing for your Seder for ages. Your wife has prepared the kitchen and the food, and you've been preparing the Haggadah, and you went to the mikveh on the day before Pesach, on the afternoon before Pesach, and you came home from work early to get yourself ready, and everything's beautiful, and you got the most expensive, beautifully made kosher matzah deluxe that you could find. It so happens they're not right. They weren't made correctly. They were baked in 18 and a half minutes instead of under 18 minutes. But you don't even know that. Have you got a mitzvah of matzah? No. You don't. All the best intention of the world doesn't make a computer work. All the best intention in the world doesn't make a piece of matzah. That's not matzah. What happens if you decide to make Pesach unknown to you? You think Pesach is on Monday night, and really it's on Tuesday night. So on Monday night, you sit and you have your four glasses of wine, and you have your Pesach, and you do your whole thing with good kosher matzah. Does it work? What's wrong? The physical dimensions are there, and the intention is there. Timing is wrong. It's not matzah on Monday night. When I say it's not matzah, it is from a confectioner's point of view, from a baker's point of view, it's matzah. But in terms of the halachic definition of matzah, there's a component missing, timing. It changes its essence. It isn't matzah that night. What you had was not a seder. What you drank was not the four glasses. You drank four glasses of wine, but not the arba kosos. The timing was wrong. What happens if you keep Shabbos on Friday? Or on Thursday? Or on Sunday? It's not Shabbos. It's a nice day. It's a nice day off. It's a nice day of leisure, but it's not Shabbos. The timing is wrong. So timing is a critical element of structure in a religious sense, just as it is in a physical sense. Now, when it comes to prayer, for example, prayer is not meditation. There's a very big difference, and the difference is structure. Meditation is almost, as far as I understand it, I'm no expert in meditation, if anybody here is, tell me if I'm wrong, but as I understand it, meditation is almost the absolute removal of structure. It's the destructuring of structure to the extreme, to the point where there is no remnant of anything structural, and there find yourself. And we say, finding yourself where there's no structure, what's the point? There's no, you can't find yourself there. You can only find yourself in a relationship. You can only find yourself when you are engaged with something. And that something has to be defined. Your engagement is subjective. The way you engage, that's human. But the object with which you engage has to be real. You can't engage with an illusion. I'm beginning to learn that in Los Angeles that's not so clear. But leaving Los Angeles aside, in most places, you can't engage with an illusion. It's got to be real to engage with it. And prayer is not meditation. Tefillah is not meditation. Tefillah, in davening, in prayer, there is the creation of something that has structural dimensions. For example, the Shmona Esra that you daven for Mincha and the Shmona Esra that you daven for Ma'ariv. Any differences? Is there one word of difference? No. So if you say two Shmona Esras for Mincha, will that get you through Ma'ariv? No, time. Time is not. So the structure is, and if you say, instead of saying the Shema today, I'm going to read the Psalms today. The whole book of Psalms. And in reading the book of Psalms and reading Tehillim, I'm going to think about God and I'm going to accept His mitzvahs. All the things you're supposed to think about during the Shema, I will think about as I say the Psalms. So my thoughts are all 100% focused. But they're focused on the Psalms, not on the Shema. Have I got the mitzvah of the Shema? Have I done it? No, I haven't. I've missed it. So davening is also a structure. There is a structure with which one is engaging. That's why we hold a siddur. We don't just meditate with our eyes closed. They're words, specific words, designed poetically, designed with a great deal of precision. And davening is our relationship with those words, not our relationship with God. Our relationship with God is the outcome of relating to the words, is the outcome of relating to the structure of prayer. From that we create the divine. Just as a musician who sits down at the piano or at his violin and creates divinity in his music. He doesn't do it by relating to God. Imagine if you paid $75 for a concert ticket and the musician came on with no violin. And you said, well, what is all this? He said, this is divinity. This is real spiritual stuff. This is so spiritual, I'm not going to use a violin. I ask you all to close your eyes and imagine this piece of music I'm about to play. And I'm not going to distract you with coarse sounds that come from a wooden instrument. Use your soul. I mean, this kind of thing could happen in Los Angeles, couldn't it? One could imagine it happening. One could imagine it happening. But there is no divinity in vacuum. Divinity is the consequence and the outcome of engaging with something real in a way that produces divinity. That's where you find divinity. That's why we find no divinity in meditation. You cannot find God in meditation. You can find a big empty vacuum. That's what you can find in meditation. Not God. You find God in action. That's why we don't keep 2 minutes of silence. That's why you'll find that many people get very offended, and rightly so from a point of view of manners, but wrongly so ideologically, when that siren goes off on Yom HaZikaron in Israel. What do the religious people do? They carry on doing whatever they're doing. What do we do to remember the dead? Say Kaddish. Don't stand in silence. Don't be inactive. Don't disengage from the world. That's not a Jewish concept. That's an idolatrous concept. It's an anti-Jewish concept. You want to remember the dead, do something in their name. Give charity. Do a kindness. Say Kaddish. Learn a piece of Torah. Do something. Teach something to somebody. Do something. Create divinity out of engagement, not out of vacuum. And if there's going to be engagement, it's engagement with something. And if it's engagement with something, that something has to have very clearly defined dimensions, including time. Shaul has to fight a battle. The battle consists of a war. There are dimensions and structure to the war. Implements that have to be used, strategies that have to be followed, timing. There has to be intent, there has to be passion, there has to be energy. All the subjective things there has to be motivation. All the subjective things need to be in place as well. The other leg on which the success of the war depends is sacrifice and prayer. That too needs a good heart and the correct structure. Part of the structure is the prophet brings the sacrifice. And the timing, he determines, 7 days. Doesn't matter how bad the war situation is looking. That's the structure required for prayer. And in their environment, prayer was as important as the battle. Today it's different. But in their environment, the prayer was as important as the battle itself. So Shaul now has to make a decision. The structure is wrong. The intention is right. The heart is pure. But the structure is wrong. The timing is wrong. Shaul's shmuel is not there. Shaul makes a decision. And he acts. He brings the sacrifice. And Shmuel comes and says, you've undermined the principle of perfect structure in the creation of the object of engagement. You've created something flawed. You've created something vacuous. You've created a sacrifice that is no sacrifice. You've created prayer that is no prayer, because one of the critical dimensions is missing. And so your heart is good, your intention is good, but the structure is incorrect, the structure is imbalanced. And what is Shaul's response? Shaul says, the reason I did it, I saw the people were disappearing. And you hadn't come at the time that we said, and the Plishtim were coming. I was scared. I was losing my army. I reacted to the pressure of reality, of society around me, says Shaul, and Shmuel gets angry. After Shmuel's anger, later on in one of the coming chapters, Shaul says, I'm sorry. You're right. I made a mistake. There's another element to Shaul's action that is serious. And that is his admission. He doesn't start with an admission. Shmuel comes and says, you destroyed the structure. You damaged the perfection of the structure. Shaul does not say, you're right. I was wrong. I thought you weren't going to come. I should just have waited a little longer. I didn't. He starts off with a justification process. I had no choice. I really didn't want to do it. I wanted to wait for you. But I forced myself to do it to be, because I believed that without that, I was going to lose my army altogether. So I made that decision. Later on, he says, I was wrong, I made a mistake. Compare that to the father, the ancestor of King David, Yehuda. Yehuda's great moment. Yehuda has a daughter-in-law, Tamar, you remember. And Tamar loses her husband. Before they have any children, she expects the mitzvah of Yibum to take place, that she will be married to her husband's brother. That doesn't work out. And so, continuing the laws of Yibum, she figures out that her only chance of marrying into this family and having children from them, which she realizes prophetically is going to lead to the foundation of the house of King David, is with Yehuda himself. And for reasons which we're not going to go in now, but it's an important discussion which we should have sometime, she does not go to Yehuda straight out and say, look, I think you and I better get married. Yehuda has become a widow at this stage as well. But she dresses up as an attractive street girl, as a harlot, and she attracts Yehuda's attention that way. And they have a relationship. He doesn't know that it's his daughter-in-law. Word gets out that Tamar is pregnant. And she's brought to court. She, again, what's wrong with that is that she has the law of the daughter of the Kohen. Quite an involved halachic issue, why it's so serious in her case. It's not just the case of a pregnancy out of marriage. Is normally not as severe as it was in Tamar's case. This was a severe thing. So here's Yehuda, the leader, the chief rabbi, the Av Beis Din, the tzaddik, and he hears that Tamar is pregnant. Tamar is brought to court. He's on the bench. She knows she's going to be put to death unless she comes out with the truth. Yehuda, the presiding judge, is the father. And she has to make a choice. She decides not to come out with the truth. Instead, she very cleverly kept a souvenir that he left with her, and she very silently passes it over to Yehuda and says, open this package. The man who owns the souvenir is the father of my baby. So she puts the whole thing in Yehuda's lap. Of course, Yehuda was quite free to open it up. Think of Yehuda's career now. Yehuda was quite free to open up the package and say, I really don't know whose this is, so can we get on with the case? And that would have been the end of it. She would never have disclosed who the father of the child was. And from that we learn some interesting things. That choice she made, she would never embarrass Yehuda. It would be left for him to decide whether he was going to reveal the truth, but she wasn't. What does Yehuda say? As this occurs, by Yomer he says, Sodko mimeni. She's the righteous one, not I. I am the father of the child, and this is why I did it. Immediately. If you look at the downfall of so many politicians recently, the last 20 years, the downfall was not what they did. The downfall was the length of time it took them to admit. And there are reasons for that. Each one thinks it'll get over, he'll be able to explain it, and that'll be the end of it, and it'll be easier to handle it that way. But in each and every case, had they come forward, the only one who got it right in recent history that I know of was Kennedy, with the Bay of Pigs. It was my responsibility. I blew it. I took a bad decision. This is what I thought. This is what I was told. I was wrong. On my head. He was forgiven. Although people died in the process, he was forgiven. Nobody held it against him. He became a national hero. The others who did minor things compared to that, they didn't kill anybody. They didn't blow. It wasn't a national disaster. It's a private indiscretion. Nobody died. Even Watergate, nobody died. Unforgiving. Because there was an attempt at explaining it away before there was an admission. With Yehuda, there was no attempt to explain anything away. Tzadka mimeni. She's right. I'm wrong. This is what happened. Although that could have destroyed him as a human being, he wasn't prepared to destroy her as a human being. the result of that is, in the blessings at the end of Bereshit, in Parshas Vayechi, when Yaakov gives each of his sons a blessing and he comes to Yehuda, he says the following, among other things. Gur Aryeh Yehuda. Yehuda is the lion cub. And he describes him, Lo yosur shevet mi Yehuda, u'mechokek mi bein raglov. The throne will never depart from the household of Yehuda. And that's attributed to his capacity to acknowledge, to admit. And that's in his name. Yehuda comes from the word moedeh, to admit. And that's essential to the house of King David. Not so to King Saul. That was Saul's downfall. The attempt to first explain and then admit. As opposed to admit and then deal with the damage. And King David too. What did he do? Serious things, as we're going to learn when we came. Really serious things. And Nosson HaNovi, the prophet of the time, Nathan comes along and confronts him with it. Immediately, David says, yes, that's what I did. How can I repair it? What do I do to fix it? Let's try and repair the damage. No attempt to explain it away. Not so Shaul. And he's criticized, says the Gemara, listen to this one. Mipnei manena Shaul. Why was Shaul punished? And Rashi explains the punishment we're talking about is not that his kingdom was taken away from him. But the punishment we're talking about is lovo lidei dovah sha'olav nitam imenu malchus. Why was he brought into this situation? Why did God give him this opportunity to make this mistake, which resulted in him losing his kingdom? Why did God not bring Shmuel in time? Why was Shmuel delayed along the way? Why was Shaul put in this terrible dilemma where he was losing his army and Shmuel hadn't appeared? Why didn't God just save him from being in that dilemma? Explains the Gemara, Mipnei shemochal al kavodei, because he forgave people. Strange thing for the Gemara to say. Do you remember the case a few chapters back when people commented just after his appointment, what will this one save us? Will he be able to do anything for us? Do you remember that? They undermined his dignity. The law is, if you undermine the dignity of a king, that's a capital offense. A king can't function if his dignity is undermined. It's not possible. A king has to have dignity in order to function. And the undermining of the dignity of a king is a capital offense. It's treasonous because it makes the country ungovernable. And the king has, according to Halakha, no discretion in forgiving an undermining of his dignity. Anybody else has that discretion. If a son undermines a father's dignity, the father can be boichel. Doesn't have to punish the child. If somebody undermines, a student undermines a teacher's dignity, the teacher can forgive. But a king is not allowed to forgive. Because forgiving the undermining of his dignity damages society. It's not just between him and the other party. It's a matter of the whole of society. It affects God as well. It affects the nation. That's something he is not the custodian of his own dignity. The nation is the custodian of his dignity. And the nation and the Torah is the custodian of his dignity. And the Torah does not allow a king to be undermined and does not allow a king who has been undermined to forgo that undermining and to forgive it. And Shaul forgave them. It doesn't matter. Let them be. It doesn't bother me. What do we see here? Do we see a great man or do we see a weak man? And the answer is, we see a man who is so great that he becomes weak. Can you follow what I mean by that? That weakness is a sort of a curved graph. That greatness is a kind of a curved graph. The greater you are, the stronger you become. But there's a point where the greatness brings a certain weakness. What was the opening phrase? He was like a one-year-old who'd never tasted sin. A one-year-old has great purity, never tasted sin, never harmed anybody, never been malicious. A one-year-old's like a little angel. And yet, strength of character, no. Ability to stand up for himself, not really. To stand up for a principle for somebody else, certainly not. With naivety, very often goes weakness. And that's tough to understand, particularly in our society today, that celebrates what is the word really? Morality, to the point where morality actually starts to become immoral. One can reach such a level of morality that it starts to become immoral. Can you think of what I'm thinking of? I'm thinking of a view that says, let the Arabs have half of Israel. Let the Arabs have all of Israel. They were there first, after all. Is that moral? Yes? That's the moral view. Definitely the moral view. We conquered it. That's not a nice thing to do, to conquer. Conquest is not moral. So the moral thing to do is to say we're sorry. Pay reparations. What did America do after the war? They invested money in the people they conquered. Israel should give back the land they conquered, all of it, including Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Haifa, the lot. We should pay reparations for the damage we did in the conquest process and disappear. That's the moral thing to do. Morality and greatness don't always go hand in hand. There is a point at which morality becomes naive. And the art is in figuring out the maximum point, the high point at which morality and greatness work hand in hand. And there's such a thing as a king being too nice to the point where he can't be king. A king has to have a ruthless streak. A king has to be able to put somebody to death. A parent. I was listening to one of these talk shows. They're so fascinating. And somebody just called in, and I don't even remember what this topic of discussion was. It wasn't really important. But she described so graphically a mother in a shopping mall trying to bribe her child to stop having a tantrum. And she said, simply, parents are terrified by their children. The children are the terrorists today. The parents are so conditioned that being harsh on a child is cruel, and cruelty is bad. Therefore, don't be harsh on a child. Discipline is harsh. Harsh is cruel. Cruelty is immoral. So don't be cruel. Don't be harsh. Don't discipline. That's the kind of moral reasoning that takes place. Disciplining in a classroom. It's something that the police forces in this country are grappling with at the moment. That they've got to be nice. Otherwise, they get people complain about them, and their careers are limited. You can't have to be nice and be a policeman and deliver the results for the community that you're being asked to deliver when the criminals aren't being nice. So a nice person can't become a policeman. A great person can become a policeman. Do you understand the difference I'm talking about? A nice person and a great person? Not great people aren't sweet as sugar. There is an element of great people that has to be able to be harsh. The Gemara goes on. We don't have time to analyze this next piece, but I do want to do it sometime. Maybe next week, but probably later on. Kol Talmid Chochom she'eno noikem v'noiter kenachash eino Talmid Chochom. Any Talmid Chochom, any sage, any great leader who doesn't avenge and revenge like a snake is not a Talmid Chochom. And the Gemara goes on to say, but it says in the Torah you're not allowed to take revenge and you're not allowed to avenge. The Gemara goes into a very interesting discussion which we should have. I'm just showing you that dimension, that you can't be a sweetie pie and be great. Sweetie pie and greatness doesn't go together. Sweetie pie is sweetie pie and great is great. That doesn't mean one has to be vicious and destructive and vindictive. But there has to be a firmness. There has to be an ability to be tough and the ability to choose when to exercise that toughness and when not to. Never to be tough because you don't know how to be tough, that's nothing. That's absolute nothingness. Not being able to discipline, not disciplining a child because you cannot. That means you're the child. That's what it means. You're the one-year-old. And it's very nice and naive, as the Tanakh says about Shaul himself. Like a one-year-old, beautifully pure. But not a king. Just not a king. And we see it three times. The first time we see it is when they undermine him and he says, forget it, let them be. Can't do that if you're a king. The second time is the army is deserting him. He gives in to pressure. The third time we'll have next week. And that's why he's called Shaul. What does Shaul mean? Shoel, he asks. You know, a leader can't ask sometimes. He's got to act and fix it up afterwards. Somebody who always has to be given permission and can't act unless he's given permission. Nice guy. Would you like to employ such a person? Never does anything without permission? I wouldn't. I wouldn't want such a person in my employ. What a waste. Why have somebody who never does anything without permission? Then I might as well be the only person there. You want somebody who'll take the risk sometimes and act sometimes immediately without getting the permission. Sometimes even doing something that you might not allow. Because in fact their judgment might be better than yours in that particular case. And occasionally you'll make some good decisions because somebody goes beyond what you're able to see. Within limits. But certainly in a leadership situation there cannot be a sha'ul, the man who always has to ask for public approval. Always has to check the polls. How is the public rating me? If they're rating me too bad, I'd better adjust. Sha'ul, I'm asking the public. Always asking the public. That's not a king. That's not greatness. That's a sweetie pie. Always wants to ask permission. He's sweet, but he's not a king. And that's Shaul's objection. King David made some errors, but he didn't undermine the essence of being a king. He was a king through and through. When he sinned as a king. When he repented as a king. He never compromised his kingship. Shaul was never really a king. He was always the one who was asking. He was always temporary. He was always there at the will of the people. And that isn't royalty. And of course, royalty, as we mentioned when we gave the series its name, royalty is something that exists not only in the appointed kings of the nation. Royalty is something that each one of us have and need to develop within us. There needs to be a part of us that has the capacity to be king. The part of us that has the capacity to do something beyond what we're permitted to do, what we have been given permission to do. Something that goes beyond what the public allows us to do. Something that allows us to make judgments. Something that allows us to be harsh if we have to. That we have the capacity to be harsh when we need to be. We try not to be. We'll try and prevent it. We'll try and avoid it. But if we have to, we can. And people know that. There's an element of royalty that has to exist within us that we have to understand as we study the greatness, the heights, and the failures of these great people. Shaul being one of them, one of the greatest we've had, and yet, great as a human being, fine, noble, but flawed as a king, a man who needs to ask permission. We'll study that further in Netz Hashem next week.